Welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Robert Sullivan about the Royal Arch of Enoch. Very interesting conversation. A lot to talk about. There's a lot of things in his book. There's a lot of things surrounding, of course, the research that Robert has been doing that poses new questions and everything else. And we're going to do the best we can to check off all the notes that we have. But there's a lot more. I wanted to ask you first, Robert, if you've encountered anything of this type of thinking, if you will, or this type of research that you're doing within the Masonic world, if any of this knowledge that you've attained was received basically because you're in Freemasonry.
Yeah, I would say yes to that, but I would say that the information is available pretty much to anyone. Certainly for me, you know, when we talk, I mean, there's a couple writers out there who definitely, I mean, some are Masonic, some are not, who definitely influenced me. I guess one of them is, of course, Albert Pike, who wrote this massive book called The Morals and Dogma of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. It's an interesting book, but it's really more about symbolism. What Pike does is when a Masonic ritual is mentioning a symbol, what Pike does is he goes back in antiquity and says, well, you know, this represented this to the Eleusinian mysteries, and to the Egyptians it was this, and to the Greco-Romans it was this. And he just constantly keeps going back in time. Then of course you have Manly Palmer Hall. I really like his work. The British historian Frances Yates, obviously she's not a Mason, but she wrote extensively about the Hermetic tradition, the influence of like Rosicrucianism, the occult philosophy of the Elizabethan age. That's one of her, that's actually one of the titles of her books. There's a British, an English architectural historian that is very good on this material named James Stephen Curl. I have his book here. It's called The Art and Architecture of Freemasonry. He gets a lot into the Hermetic tradition of Freemasonry, the mystery tradition, these concepts of, you know, the dying and resurrected sun god. Then he also gets into concepts relating to Mozart's magic flute opera, you know, even going so far as some of the set designs and stuff. You know, those books are, you know, always, you know, influential on me. And, you know, I think most of them, by and large, are probably, you know, ready, available to the public. I know for a fact the Manly Palmer Hall book is, I think, free online. I mean, I don't even think that's under copyright law anymore. I think that's just in the public domain. I think the Pike book is also. But, yeah, you know, those are definitely works that, you know, if you're interested in Masonic symbolism and antiquity, those are definitely books you want to check out.
And then you have Albert Mackey and some of those people as well, as you mentioned before. And a lot of this is now then out in the open, you know, with the aid of Google and potentially the you know, random library here and there. You can actually find out quite a bit of Masonry. And this is something that I think they've been trying to keep the lid on for a long time, but this is, you know, slowly kind of opened up. And has that changed Freemasonry or anything? Has it changed anything of the traditions within there, or, you know, because it's a different world now than it was, you know, even just 20, 30 years ago?
Henrik, this is a great question you just asked me. I'm going to give you the honest answer. It's made it more popular. At least over here in
really?
The States. No doubt. Over here, I mean, over here in the, I'm in Maryland, and my Masonic Lodge, I just know that, you know, it's stuff like you talk, what we were talking about, like, you know, sort of this mystical tradition, the esoteric, people are fascinated by this, you know, and you get into sort of, you know, I mean, I hate to say this, but, you know, the popularity of stuff like Da Vinci Code and National Treasure and stuff like that. Mm. I can tell you for a fact that if you go back, I want to say, to like around the mid-2000s, like around 2005, 2006, the Masonic Lodge that I'm in, every month I get a little, you know, booklet in the mail telling me about, you know, what are the upcoming events at the Masonic Lodge. I mean, my lodge meets, you know, the first and third Thursdays of each month. They don't meet in the summer, but that's another story. And I remember getting this monitor and you would just see, you know, nothing was going on. I mean, you know, there was maybe you'd get one guy being initiated every 3 or 4 months. Well, now, my goodness, you get it. I mean, and they're putting through, you know, 10, 15 people a month, you know, through the Entered Apprentice degree, then they're doing the Fellowcraft. I mean, it just seems like, you know, most people have really, you know, at least, you know, the people joining it right now, it seems to be like a new generation almost that just seem to be much more interested in the esoteric side of Freemasonry. They did a poll here, I can't remember who did it. It may have been the Scottish Rite in D.C. Don't hold me to that. But they would poll Masons, especially guys like in the Blue Lodge, and they do it. It's like a census almost. They would do it like every 3 or 4 years, and they would ask them, you know, why did you become a Freemason? You know, what was sort of your motivation for joining? And the answer was always the same up until about a year ago. I mean, the answers that were always given was to do charity work or to, you know, continue like a family tradition. You know, like my grandfather was one, so I wanted to join one.
Right.
Well, they did this poll last summer, and it came out, and the number one reason was the reason they wanted to join was because they were interested in mysticism and the esoteric side of it.
Huh.
So, yeah, I mean, it definitely seems that, you know, it seems that there's, like you said, we're in a new world almost, and it seems that, you know, the esoteric side of things is kind of coming back in the swing, if you will.
Well, that's interesting. Unexpected. I mean, and of course, counter to this, you have to have a lot of growing anti-masonry out there as well. I think this must work both ways, I believe, right?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, sure. You know, when it gets popular, of course, then you have the people come out and attack it, and, you know, we'll say that it's, you know, unchristian or, you know, whatever. I mean, one of the interviews, you know, I mean, I mentioned this before. I mean, I've received, you know, some mean-spirited email over on Facebook. I just delete it. You know, I don't get engaged with these people or just get into an online argument with them. But yeah, I mean, you know, with one comes the other, and you know, you definitely have, you know, your anti-Masonic influence out there, no doubt about it.
Well, and people also forget, I mean, this has gone up and down in history. I think in the U.S., one of the more popular parties there for a while was the Anti-Masonic Party. I think it was actually the first third party in the United States.
Yeah.
And I mean, it spawned out of the Morgan affair, of course. It was a murder and everything else. And so there's a lot of anti-sentiment there, so which is understandable. And what do you make of that, though? Is there anything, I mean, is there validity to the criticism? Because after all, if this is a network of, well, I think I read somewhere there's about 7 million Masons in the world altogether, something like that. That's like a small country, pretty much.
So yeah, yeah.
This is, that means, in other words, it would be impossible for me to say that all Swedes are good people. You know, living in Sweden, that's about 9 million people, because I don't know everyone, I don't have a connection with them and everything else. So my question has always been, okay, well, could it be that someone has also used the network of Masonry to, you know, have it into their advantage because of the secrecy, because of the underground nature of it for the longest time? It's been kind of a good infrastructure for it. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I see what you're getting at. I could just speak from my experience. I mean, I have never really, for me personally, never received any sort of, you know, economic or benefit of some kind from being in the Freemasonry. I think if you join it for that reason, you're really joining it for the wrong reason. I mean, my interest in it was just sort of as a sort of esoteric brotherhood. You know, if you want to join Freemasonry to sort of create this, you know, to become part of some sort of secret network, you're probably joining it for the wrong reason. That's really not my take on it. I mean, I see what you're saying. You know, I mean, I could certainly see where people, you know, think that way. That's all good and fine. You know, when you're talking about anti-Masonry, you know, of the William Morgan affair, you know, I mean, that was sort of really, you know, that was really one of the incidents that kind of, you know, almost ended the Masonic reign, if you will, you know, in the United States. Up until then, Masonry was kind of perceived as this really great fraternal order, patriotic, you know, associated with Washington, Franklin. But then the William Morgan affair came along, and this was sort of, you know, he was, what caused the problem was he was going to expose this Royal Arch secret, this word, which, you know, if you know, I'm not allowed to say it, but if you know what the word is, it's a composite of three pagan deities.
I know what it is. I can say it. Jabulon.
You could say it. I can't. And at any rate, it's this word that gets a lot of gets Freemasonry in trouble, and he threatens to expose it. And I mean, you know, there's definitely, you know, you got guys like DeWitt Clinton getting involved with it, who was the governor of New York at the time, and it really put a negative damper on Freemasonry. A lot of lodges are just completely wiped out. I mean, I know in Maryland, where my membership is, I mean, I think Maryland lost 50% of its Masonic lodges. I think in either Vermont or New Hampshire, one of the Grand Lodges had to close down. And it really, what it did for Freemasonry was it forced them at this point to kind of shy away from the sort of esoteric, mystical side of things. And Freemasonry survives it, you know, notwithstanding the anti-Masonic party of William Wirt, this is, like you said, this is the first third party, politics in America. The anti-Masonic party's nominating convention was downtown Baltimore. I mean, it's not too far from where I'm sitting right now. You know, Wirt doesn't really go anywhere. He's defeated soundly by Andrew Jackson, who himself was a Mason. And it takes Masonry years to recover, and it does recover, and Masonry and Blue Lodge basically reemerge as sort of this fraternal charity organization. That's how they're able to withstand it.
Do you think it was more esoteric at that point, or has it become more esoteric today into the kind of the occult arts and hidden knowledge and everything else?
I think after the Morgan affair, Masonry became this sort of, you know, de facto, well, not that's not the right word, just sort of this fraternal brotherhood that's sole purpose was charity work. I think that idiom survived basically mostly of it. I mean, I'm not talking about the Scottish Rite or York Rite. I'm just talking about Blue Lodge right now.
Yeah, try to repair its image or something like that. That's why this happens.
I agree. Maybe. Yeah, I agree with that. It seems to have that image all the way through the 19th century and into the 20th century. And it's really of late, I would say it's probably within the last 10 years, where now all of a sudden the concepts of this mystical knowledge, the esoteric wisdom, you know, that seems to be becoming more and more popular again.
Yeah. Martin Short over in England has written a good book about called Inside the Brotherhood that shows a little bit on the other side of this as well. That I recommend for reading to balance everything out there. But there's a lot of interesting things in your book, Robert, that I want to return to as well. We talked about the name of God a little bit earlier and why this. I wanted to ask you more about why this is important and if we can begin to make some distinctions here as well, because there's a lot of different symbols. Either we can go the way of saying, well, they all kind of mean the same thing, or there's a significant difference between them. If we look at the Royal Arch degree, we have, you know, Jabulon, as I mentioned before. We have the Tetragrammaton. We have the Triple Tau and a lot of these symbols that are coming up. But many of them, of course, resonate the three. It's a tripartite kind of unity here, if you will. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that and see if there's any difference between all these symbols and deities that I've mentioned so far.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you get into the Royal Arch, you know, symbology, like you said, you've got, you know, the Tetragrammaton is just really another way of saying, you know, the name of God. The name that you were talking about is really part of more of the, you know, this is the name that the Masons just give. I mean, no Mason really believes that that's the true name of God. I mean, I can tell you that right now. I mean, that's just a name they use. When you get into triple division, and this sort of ties into, this to me goes almost back to, you know, the Blue Lodge, where you have the first three degrees, the ultimate, you know, emblem, you know, when you get into really triple division, what you're really talking about is it's the sun. It's the three phases of the sun. It's the rising sun, the sun at noon, and the setting sun. And this is reflected in Blue Lodge governance, where the worshipful master sits in the east representing a rising sun. One of the wardens sits in the south representing the sun at meridian, and of course the other warden sits in the west representing the setting sun. This is the, you know, triple division of government, the three phases of the sun, if you will. This is mentioned in Anderson's Constitutions of Freemasonry, and Mackey talks about this also, and I argue in my book that it's this triple division is where you get the triple division of government from the United States between an executive, a legislature, and a judicial, which is, of course, you know, the three branches of government in the United States. Mm. I mean, I believe they're borrowing that directly from Anderson's Constitutions. I mean, it's really a solar emblem. This goes back to the concept of the Trinity, the Holy Trinity, where, it's God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Ghost, which is, you know, God the Father is the rising sun, God the Son, the youthful sun, is the sun at full strength at noon, and of course, the sun becomes a mystical entity entering the underworld as a holy ghost when it sets in the west at night. This is talked about in the works of Kircher, and, you know, to me, that's sort of where the ultimate concept of this triple division comes from, if I'm making sense.
Oh, yeah, sure, definitely. Tons of solar symbolism, and this seems to be one of the main tenets, of course. I think you even, talk about the Great Seal of the United States being, basically this solar symbolism. But you also make the distinction now, you only don't say Masonic symbolism, but you say Enochian / Masonic, that this is like, it's kind of the same thing. That's what you're getting at here.
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, my take on it is this, and I put this in the book, is when you understand, let's just backpedal just a little bit. It's the Royal Arch of Enoch degree. Well, what number is it? I mean, it's the 13th degree. I mean, and this is your number 13 symbolism, that's replete over the seal.
Yeah.
This has been hashed out. I mean, I agree that there's probably some, you mentioned this earlier when we're talking about symbolisms, you always have to bear in mind that there's different levels of the symbolism. I mean, there's usually not just one slam dunk answer.
Sure.
You're dealing with different levels of symbology. I mean, for example, when we get into that number 13, I mean, I don't disagree that this doesn't represent the 13 colonies, but I mean, I definitely think that's more of an exoteric explanation. I think there's also a very esoteric explanation. I think it relates to this, that number 13 relates to this 13th degree, this Enoch Royal Arch degree, where this lost name of God is ultimately recovered, and is responsible for the restoration of this lost knowledge. That's detailed in the book.
Maybe we could talk about Ethiopia a little bit more. You basically mentioned that the Book of Enoch is brought out from Ethiopia. There's a lot of interesting things that have taken place there. There's some authors and scholars that are pointing to even that the Ark of the Covenant might still be or have been at some point, located in Ethiopia. How much of that are you going to in the book, Robert?
Yeah, I think there's something to that. Ethiopian lore isn't my bailiwick, but I will answer your question this way. And it's funny you mentioned the Ark of the Covenant, because this is a key factor with this thing. There are scholars who believe that this Ark of the Covenant of Moses is actually located in Ethiopia. Well, if you fast forward in time and you go to the Scottish Rite degree and the York Rite degree, the Royal Arch degree, in the Scottish Rite it's called Enoch or Solomon, and in the other one in the York Rite it's the Royal Arch of Zerubbabel. We'll just start with the Scottish Rite. Well, we talk about the recovery of the name of God, the Tetragrammaton on this golden delta. But what I haven't mentioned yet is, well, where is it located in the vault? And in the vault in the Scottish Rite, the Tetragrammaton is recovered on what's called the foundation stone, which is this stone that once, that the Ark of the Covenant once sat in the Holy of Holies in Solomon's temple. So by association, you are associating the Tetragrammaton with the Ark of the Covenant, which the divine presence of God, if you will. In the York Rite, the Tetragrammaton is actually located on the Ark of the Covenant. I mean, it's the actual Ark. Sometimes it's called a substitute Ark. But if you've gone through the York Rite, the Tetragrammaton, the name of God, is actually located on the Ark of the Covenant. And that comes out of Thomas Smith Webb's Illustrations of Freemasonry, which basically served as the template for that high degree in the United States.
Well, I've always wondered, because of the etymological connection between the word arch and ark, if there's anything more to that than just, a letter difference.
I think there's definitely something to that. And I think also you get into etymological symbolisms. I mean, this goes back to what, we were talking about in the first segment. If you really step back for a minute and just look at this, what are we really talking about here? You look at the Ark, when you look at the Vault of Enoch, and let's just stick with the Ark of the Covenant, that's Ark, A-R-K, that's where the Tetragrammaton is, that is hidden in this underground vault that's going to survive the flood of Noah. Well, what does Noah survive in? I mean, an Ark, an A-R-K, I mean, it's the same thing. It's when you look at the, symbology, it's Noah and the humans and the animals surviving in an ark, and it's this lost wisdom surviving in an ark. It's fascinating.
So is it really a symbolic, that there actually isn't a Ark of the Covenant, but it's a symbolic reference to how knowledge is being maybe attained then within degrees or something like that? Is that what they're alluding to?
It, it, Yeah, I mean, it could be. I mean, it could be. I just think it's interesting that the same word, ark, is being used to preserve this lost knowledge, but it's also the same thing that's what's keeping mankind alive, basically. There definitely seems to be some sort of, you know, mystical, you know, connection between the two there. It's just a fascinating subject matter. Out of all the things that those two words, you know, use, you know, to survive this thing, it's the same thing, basically.
That's right. Well, I wanted to ask a little bit more about the degree, again, if we go back and look at the structure of Freemasonry, and if we're on the Scottish Rite side, the 13th is the master of the ninth arc, or arch, actually, to be, say that, pronounce that correct. And we previously we talked about the two main arches that people might be aware of when it comes to discussions of Freemasonry is Jachin and Boaz and everything else. But does this mean that there's ninth and continuous arches in Freemasonry?
No, I can explain that. When what you're talking about is in the 13th degree. In the 13th degree, it's the Tetragrammaton being recovered in this underground vault. In the southern jurisdiction, it's called the Royal Arch of Enoch or the Royal Arch of Solomon. In the ritual, when the treasure vault is located, the Tetragrammaton is under nine archways. That's what Enoch built, these nine underground archways. When you talk about Knight of the Ninth Arch, that's the 13th degree. It's what it's called, the Knight of the Ninth Arch. It's the 13th degree, but it's only in the northern jurisdiction. It's the same ritual.
Okay.
It's in the Scottish Rite, but it's in the northern jurisdiction. Jachin and Boaz are, this is confusing. This confuses people. In the underground vault, you have the Pillars of Enoch, which has this lost knowledge inscribed on them. That is not Jachin and Boaz. That they are something totally something different. Jachin and Boaz are these two pillars that sat on the front porch of King Solomon's temple, but they are not the Pillars of Enoch. They are something completely else.
And the underground vault that you're talking about, is this a symbolic vault, or is it something actually that's part of the of a lodge that you and others are part of?
Well, it's part of the ritual. It's the ritual. It's the 13th degree, and what's happening is, whether you want to say this is just an allegory, if it's real history, that's up to the individual person. But when the ritual occurs, what's going on is these Hebrew stonemasons are returning to the Holy Land from their captivity in Babylon, and they're rebuilding they're returning to the Temple Mount to rebuild the second temple. King Solomon's temple, remember, has already been destroyed. So they're going back from Babylon, and the Jewish governor who's leading the way is this guy's name. His name's Zorobabel, and his name literally means, it depends on who you want to talk to, it literally means either the path to Babylon or the mouth of Babylon.
Hmm.
And he's returning under the warrant of a guy named Cyrus the Great, who is this Zoroastrian Mithraic Persian emperor. And when Zorobabel goes back, they're starting construction on the second temple, and it's when they're building the second temple that they find this key stone in the ground, and they recognize it as the symbol of this archway. Anyway, they investigate the keystone, and this trap door springs open, and that's where the treasure vault's located. And what happens is they look down into the vault, and the sun rays come down and penetrate the vault and illuminate the Tetragrammaton. Which is of course a solar emblem, and you also have solar iconography in that degree because I'm going to try to shorten this as best I can. But as the sojourners are making their way to the temple mount, they have to pass through these four veils, and the four veils are an animal, or it's a man, an ox, an eagle, and a lion. And of course, you know, you as well as I know that this is astrological symbolisms. These are the four fixed signs, you know, of Aquarius, Leo, Taurus, Scorpio. So basically what it's representing is the sun on its annual journey, you know, symbolizing this, you know, recovery of this solarized lost word, if you will.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting too, again, going back to the common image of the structure of Freemasonry, if you look at that, on the York Rite side, the Royal Archmason is obviously depicted and or dressed, if you will, a better word, as a Jewish high priest. Basically, he has the whole, you know, the nine stones on the breastplate and everything else, and so there is a connection there, obviously, to Judaism, and in the extension, maybe even something that is Ethiopian. I don't know if you have any knowledge of that or whatnot, but there's this interesting kind of Rastafari Jewish connection. Have you ever looked into that or anything, Robert?
No, I'm not familiar with that, but I can definitely tell you that, you know, when you're dealing with, you know, the hot, you know, with that degree, you know, I mean, obviously we're talking about the rebuilding of the Second Temple, which is obviously, you know, Jewish. I mean, it's Zerubbabel is the Jewish governor who's, you know, building it.
Yeah.
Again, when you go into Blue Lodge Freemasonry, you know, and just step away from the high degrees for a minute, the whole second and third degree revolves around Solomon's Temple, who is, of course, this famous Jewish, you know, lawgiver. Of course, depending on how you want to, you know, look at this, when we get into solar iconography, the name Solomon is, you know, if you want to buy future cake, the word, you've got Sol and Amon, or sun and moon, or you could have Sol and Mono, or the one sun. So you could say, you know, Solomon is this, you know, appellation for the sun again.
Yeah.
But you know, again, when you're getting into, you know, even Blue Lodge, you know, you're talking about the construction of the first temple, which, you know, is, of course, you know, Jewish history, Jewish mysticism, if you will.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. Sol, on, as you said, the breakup, and we have the same there with Jabu. Lon, and what do you make of the if one does a simple search on Google and look at some of the depictions, and I heard this before, it actually became commonplace as well, but if you look at some of the depictions of Jabu Lon, and I want to ask you how accurate this is, or if there's anything to do with it at all. We see a spider's body, pretty much.
Oh,
it's
yeah,
a cat's head, a frog's head, and a king's head, pretty much. What is that?
Yes, that's I've seen that one too. That's that's anti-Masonic at its best. It gets Freemasonry into trouble because it's a combination of three deities. I can't say what they are, but it's the first one is, of course, you know, the Jewish God. And then you have two others, which is basically, this Babylonian deity who's associated with the sun, and another Egyptian deity, which is, of course, Osiris. I mean, that's no secret anymore. Who is this sort of solar Lord of the Dead, if you will. It's just an invention of Freemasonry, and it gets us into trouble. I mean, there's no denying that. I mean, you know, that name is you want to go for the jugular of anti-Masonry. I mean, that's the word that everyone clings to. It definitely has some, you know, has spawned some anti-Masonry out there, no doubt about that.
What do you make of that this then basically goes into the heart of syncretism, that all this is basically about merging all the different religions? We can, again, I'll stick to the Jabu Lon word. If we break this down, we have a kind of a Yah as kind of as being Jove or Jupiter, Zeus, basically, which goes to the root of a Roman, Greco, even Celtic deity. Bel or Baal is a Babylonian deity, as you said, or Canaanite, and then you have Om, which is more of a, could be an Egyptian, Hindu, or even Ethiopian deity. So that it brings all these different names of God together, basically. And so in the extension, people might say, oh, well, that's evidence that it's just syncretism, which is something which is kind of quote-unquote forbidden to do in the different denominations out there, if you know what I'm getting at.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I mean, it's really just an invention. It's a password. It's not... I mean, from my experience, it's not any sort of deity that Freemasons pray to. It's just a synchronized, you know, triple division word, combining these deities of antiquity. It definitely has anti-Masonic connotations. The word is part of high degree Freemasonry. You know, let me just say that also, it's not part of Blue Lodge Freemasonry.
Sure.
The name is lost in the Blue Lodge, but recovered, you know, in this high degree. But yeah, I mean, it's without question a source of, anti-Masonry, and definitely controversial. There's no doubt about that.
Now, there's always a lot of, you know, secrecy involved with this. I mean, even the legend of Hiram Abiffis, that he refuses to give up the knowledge of how to build. And basically, that's why he's murdered, pretty much. And there's a lot of tradition within Masonry, of course, that you're not to divulge the secrets. Is that anything that has changed in any way, even because of the web? Because just that's what we've been talking about so far. A lot of this seemed to be, you know, knowledge that was absolutely not talked about maybe, you know, 30 years ago. Now it's like all over the place and all over the web, right?
Yeah. I mean, you could definitely, I mean, the information is definitely more accessible. You know, we talk about, I'm kind of glad you brought this up. You talk about like the Blue Lodge, you know, ritual. And you know, this gets into really some, you know, really some deep arcane, information that, you know, it's out there, but you know, I mean, I haven't found it on the internet, but I, you know, Pike and Mackey hint at it. And so does Manly Hall, but you kind of have to piece it together. Really, I mean, you know, this has probably been, you know, talked about a little bit, but you know, the whole Hiram Abiff, you know, legend, that ritual of, you know, and this really gets to the heart of the matter of a lot of this, is it's the concept of the dying yet resurrected sun god is really what it ties into. Yeah, you know, I mean Hiram Abiff is basically a metaphoric stand-in for the sun. He has the name and he won't give it up, and he's killed. And the three assassins, or the three ruffians, you know, bury him under a sprig of acacia, which is a representative of the sun god Apollo. And of course, you know, Hiram Abiff is ultimately, you know, resurrected on the third try. You know, I mean, you know, dead for 3 days. I mean, where have we heard this before? You know, and when Hiram goes missing, King Solomon sends out 12 fellowcrafts to go look for him. I mean, the 12 fellowcrafts are the 12 houses of the zodiac looking for their lost sun god, basically, their lost ruler. And when Hiram Abiff is ultimately raised from the dead, he has a substitute. I'll backtrack for a minute. When they find his body, they try to raise him with the grip of an apprentice, and it doesn't work. Then they try fellowcraft, that doesn't work. So they finally raise him with what's called the strong grip of a lion's paw, which is the grip of a master mason. You know, the lion's paw is a reference to the house of Leo, which is the sole house of the sun. And you know, you really get into some really deep mystery here, because when he's raised, remember the word is lost, and when Hiram is raised, you have a substitute word whispered in your ear. And again, you know you can find this out there on the internet. I'm not allowed to say what it is, but when you're a mason, if you want to transmit this word to another mason, you have to form what's called the 5 points of fellowship. And the 5 points is a reference to the pentagram. And this ties into what Albert Pike talks about with Sirius and the Egyptian mysteries. Because what Pike says is, he says, well, that pentagram, he said that represents the dog star Sirius. Well, this is a never-ending source of confusion that I kind of really want to straighten out with people. Because what Pike is saying is, it's a reference to Sirius, and of course, in the Egyptian mystery, Sirius was Isis. Well, what does Isis have to do with, you know, Freemasonry? Well, I'm going to answer it. I'm going to tell you. It's because in the Egyptian mysteries, Isis, the Virgin Mother, like in the Royal Arch, possessed a secret name of God. She actually knew the secret name of the sun god Amun-Re or Amun-Ra. And it's through this pronunciation of this secret name that Isis was able to resurrect Osiris to birth Horus. So you see the nexus. The pentagram is Sirius. You're having a substitute word, the name of God whispered in your ear, which is a reference to the Virgin Mother, Isis, who also had this secret name of God, which she used to produce magic to sire, or to raise Osiris to birth Horus, basically. That's the nexus. And it's the same concept of, you know, the dying yet resurrected sun god, if you will.
And I always thought that Tubal Cain was a golf tournament, but it was more than that, I realized. So that was always interesting. Now, let's see here if we can move along a little bit in the list. We have so many things we want to, you know, bring up and talk about. There's more, of course, to the ideas of architecture and how much of this is incorporated into you know, basically the cities of the world and everything. And as you said, of course, this has been talked about quite a bit out there, but there's still, it's still a very, very interesting, you know, subject overall, because it means that a lot of the builders in actuality or architects have knowledge about this. And I've always been curious of how it gets incorporated into the construction, because it's something that actually is continuing. It's not only Washington D.C. and the buildings built by, you know, L'Enfant and all these people. It's more than that. It's incorporated into the big what's it called again? I always forget this one.
You'll find it in the Gothic cathedrals and, you know, sacred geometry, stuff like that. Oh yeah, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No worries. I'm trying to remember what the big construction is called. I'll get to it later. But anyway, it's something that's continuing and carrying on. So how do you think that this goes about? How is it incorporated into? Is it as simple as, okay, there's a Mason who was an architect, and therefore when he was, you know, slated to design a building or something, he incorporated it? Or how does it end up, you know, in some of these buildings today?
Yeah. I mean, it's a fascinating question. You definitely have Freemasons who are these architects, you know, and you got like guys in England like Christopher Wren, who after the Great Fire of London, his design to rebuild London was Hebrew Kabbalah, which was the Tree of Life. I mean, you look at his plan, I mean, that's obviously what it is. But yeah, you got guys like L'Enfant, Robert Mills, Latrobe. These guys are Masons. These guys would have been familiar with the works of people like Leon Battista, Raymond Lully, who's the other one? Vitruvius, Andre Palladio. Mm-hmm. And if you read their books on architecture and you get into the Hermetic tradition coming out of the Renaissance, you know, these guys talk about this like what you were saying, you know, the sacred architecture, these sacred numbers, the golden mean, the golden, you know, the Pythagorean theorem, we can get into things such as the Hermetic tradition of, you know, as above, so below, where it's the cornerstone alignments and, you know, different windows in different places almost to align with the solstices and the equinoxes. I mean, yeah, you think you've seen it all, you know, with a lot of this material, and then boom, something new pops up. And it's like, oh yeah, you know, of course, you know, how did I miss that one, basically? I mean, the one that's a classic, the one that's a good one was the, I don't know the date off the top of my head, but it was the cornerstone ceremony for the United States Supreme Court building, which it's in my book. The Supreme Court didn't have its own building up until I think around the 1950s. It used to meet in the United States Capitol, but the Supreme Court building is I want to say it's built in the 40s or 50s. I can't remember the exact date, but at any rate, the cornerstone ceremony was on October 13th, and of course this is syncretic of the House of Libra, the giant scales of justice in the sky, if you will. And, you know, I mean, there's another one. And the one with the Washington Monument is just off the chart. I mean, the cornerstone laying of that one is just, that one you just can't make up. Where when the Washington Monument was being constructed prior to the Civil War, they stopped construction on it during the American Civil War. So for about 4 or 5 years, there was no work on it. When they go back to after the Civil War is over, they go back to work on it and they relay the cornerstone, and the time of date that they pick is 10:59 a.m. And you know, I mean, why that time? I mean, that's such a, you know, screwball time. I mean, why that time? Well, if you actually go back to when the Declaration of Independence was signed on July the 4th, 1776, when basically our country was founded. The Egyptian dog star Sirius was 10 minutes 59 seconds into the house of Cancer. Sirius is the Virgin Mother Isis who possesses this name. I mean, just fascinating stuff how this stuff gets linked up together.
So who's dictating this, do you think? Who's, ordering this to take place? I absolutely agree with you. I've seen this so many times in different ways that when there's big ceremonies or rituals that's taken place, there always seems to kind of be a subtextual communication almost going on as well. If both for people who know astrology, but also of course symbolism or handshakes, what have you.
Yeah.
So who's directing all of this?
Yeah, I mean, that's like the $1 million question, isn't it? I mean, it's like, who's really behind it? I mean, it seems to be that there has to be, you know, the architects and the people putting this together are clearly influenced by this Kabbalistic knowledge. This ancient mystery tradition. It's like you said, you know, you would see this once or twice, you would just write it off as a coincidence. But when you just see this stuff over and over again, I mean, just over and over again, you know, you just realize, oh, you know, there's something you know, there's some sort of greater intelligence, you know, behind this stuff. I mean, you know, it's going on. I can't point my finger at any one person, but I mean, clearly the people who are orchestrating this are definitely, you know, have some sort of access to some sort of, or not secret, but are aware of the secret, you know, arcane knowledge, you know, astrology, you know, the movement of the planets through the heavens, the sun, the moon. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
And then we're faced with that inevitable question that, you know, I talked with, for example, Christopher Knight about, who was on the program talking about this. I've referenced it many times now, but he talked about the construction of the Pentagon, how that was, you know, being immensely rushed to be able to put together at a certain time. The whole architectural geometry behind the building is referencing what they call his co-author 366 degree geometry or you know, measuring, whatever you want to call that, and you realize then eventually that okay, someone knows all this. They have, you know, they're sending messages through ceremonies, events, and even buildings and everything. And so when people put this together, they realize, okay, it might not be flat out a Masonic force then, but a Kabbalistic one, an esoteric and a secret one. And so the conclusion one is faced with is that on top of that, all the shit that goes on in the world, people, you know, think that's the source of it as well. And when we talked with Christopher Knight about the origins of World War II, we came to the, you know, this point in our discussion that, okay, but this basically means that they knew that they were going to start World War II. They knew that they had to have this building, the Pentagon, this, you know, huge symbol in place for this grand theatrical event called World War II. So what is the true intention here? Because certainly no good fruits came out of that one.
Well, I mean, that's really the million-dollar question, is whether this is, you know, a positive or a negative thing. You know, if you want, I mean, I can't answer that question for everybody. I mean, to me, it's more of the sort of thing where, I mean, the stuff with World War II, that's beyond my, you know, I don't know really a whole lot about the architecture of the Pentagon building, you know, or how it tied into the start of World War II.
That's fascinating, like, by the way. You should listen to that show we did with Christopher Knight. I'll send you the link and listen to that.
Send me the link to it. I'll definitely, you know, well, I mean, when you get into the Third Reich, I mean, those guys were just, you know, occultists, you know. You know, I mean, those guys were just, you know, black magicians of the greatest caliber. I mean, Himmler, Hess, you know, that whole coterie.
Sure.
But, you know, I mean, that's really the million-dollar question. I mean, I think when you get into some of the stuff within the federal district, you know, like the alignments with the stars and stuff like that, I mean, I don't really see it as a overall arching negative thing. I just see it as more, you know, I mean, yeah, is there an intelligence behind it? But because, you know, it's esoteric and arcane, does that mean it's negative? I really don't see it. I can see where people see it that
sure,
way,
yeah.
But it's not the way I see it, basically.
I guess what people see today, and I don't blame them, is that if this is hold, the branches of government are located within these structures and everything else, it's also the pivotal point. You come to the realization that the whole war machine, all the corruption in the world is based out of, you know, these buildings. And it doesn't mean that every person inside of there, of course, is you know, up to speed with all the esoteric stuff. That's not what I'm alluding to. But I guess this grand plan of building this society and the world and the structure as it exists has also part of it this incredible negative tendencies that we see in the world with war, with you know, the illicit drugs and arms and everything else, and all the, you know, there is a lot of conspiracies out there, and many of them are true as well. So people put this together, obviously, and there's something that they can't, you know, avoid doing. Well, so we're all seeking what is the origin of this, who's orchestrating it, and how much of a plan is it? That's what people are trying to answer, of course.
Yeah, I mean, it's the million-dollar question, and I guess I'm just putting, you know, with my book, I'm just putting stuff out there, and you know, if a person wants to read it and think it's very negative, I mean, that's up to them. You know, I really don't see it that way. I mean, now if you want to, you know, talk about like sinister forces like Bilderberg or, you know, the Trilateral Commission and things like that nature, you know, that's really not my area of expertise or anything. I mean, I guess that would probably be more of like, you know, this negative force that's sort of hell-bent on, you know, world domination, if you will. But, you know, when you get into sort of, just on my take on it, when you get into like the federal district and the astrological alignments and stuff, you know, I mean, it's like Stonehenge. I mean, I just don't really see it as sort of this overarching negative, you know, force. I just see it more of like, you know, as, you know, esoteric mysticism, basically.
Yeah, definitely. No, I see what you're getting at. And I also think that everyone, no matter, you know, what agenda they might have, what side of the fence they're on, what have you, are when they attain a certain level, they are trying to use any force to their advantage, which means that you have people walking in the esoteric world that are doing that for, well, you know, the left-hand path and everything of that nature, you know. So it's just, you have this, even that's a symbolic reference, it's actually true in the sense that in the world as we look at it, there is this, you know, white and black representative, you know, sides, if you will, that are to a certain degree fighting with each other. And I can't help to think, I wonder how much far back that goes into the angelic realm, even, that we still have these very, very polar opposite forces that are kind of battling, and mankind is kind of, you know, stuck in between.
It's kind of like caught in the middle almost.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like this, you know, it's like you said, it's like this forces of, you know, white and black, you know, left and right, you know, going at each other. And, you know, like, you know, it's like a higher force almost, and mankind just kind of seems to be, you know, stuck in the middle of the whole thing.
And some are sucked into the battle as well, and actually are taking parts and sides in it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that. No doubt about it. I mean, you definitely have, you know, I mean, even guys, you know, just even like on a lesser level, you've got guys like, you know, Aleister Crowley and people like that who are trying to manipulate, you know, reality, you know, summon demons. You know, I mean, it, you know, it's definitely some, you know, real, you know, it can become some really, you know, dark, you know, dark, you know, crisis, you know, recesses of the world, basically.
Yeah, and the question is how far back that goes as well. We have, why don't we bring John Dee back into the conversation a little bit as well? A consultant, pretty much, to Queen Elizabeth I, as people have speculated that he actually managed to win some of the battles for Britain because of his occult knowledge. Have you heard about that?
Yeah, that's absolutely. There is. The story with Dee is, I mean, he's hanging out with this guy named Edward Kelly, and Queen Elizabeth comes to him, and he casts her horoscope, and he picks the date of her coronation, and he tells her. I mean, this is all true. I mean, this is all pinned down document. You know, and he tells her, if you get coronated on this day, you're going to herald this new golden age for England. And there is evidence, no proof, mind you, there is evidence to suggest that that Dee was basically summoning these demons to help sink the Spanish Armada in the English Channel. I mean, you know, to cause this giant storm come up.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and there is some evidence to that. There's no proof, but there's some evidence to that. Do you know the whole story? And I want to tell it if you don't know. I mean, you probably will know, but it's one of the most fascinating things out there, and it's a little of a digression, is the sigil, the sigil to Queen Elizabeth. Do you know this one?
I think I do, but tell us for our listeners, and I'll see if I catch up.
Yeah. This is just a fascinating story. John Dee was one of Walsingham's spies. And when Dee would write a correspondent to Queen Elizabeth and engaging in, you know, talking about espionage or whatever, he went to the Holy Roman Empire, he met with Rudolf II, people like that. He would sign the document 007. It was actually, if you look at the sigil, it's eyeglasses. It's two circles with a seven over them dropping down. And it was meant to symbolize that the correspondence was for her eyes only, and that he was her eyes in the field. You know, and this is where the espionage term for your eyes only comes from. Ian Fleming, the creator of the James Bond books and, you know, ultimately became the movies, worked in British intelligence during World War II and was friends with Aleister Crowley, Dennis Wheatley, and Fleming uses the sigil of 007. This is why James Bond is, you know, 007. And basically, Dee turns Bond into this symbolic John Dee type of character. And if you're familiar with the James Bond, this gets into my next book, but I'm just going to touch on it briefly. If you get into the symbolism of the James Bond stories, you're really dealing with themes of esoterica, dualism, moon and sun, male and female. the villains always have these, you know, overarching, you know, symbolic names relating to, you know, mysticism, alchemy, and during the war, and this is true also, was when Rudolf Hess, who was Hitler's deputy, flew to Scotland to try to have that botched peace treaty, Fleming, when Hess was in the Tower of London, Fleming wanted Aleister Crowley to go up into the Tower of London and perform some sort of like magic ritual on Rudolf Hess to scare him into talking about what the Nazi hierarchy's, you know, interest in astrology was, to find out some sort of maybe susceptible weakness that British intelligence could use during the war. I mean, can't make that stuff up.
Yeah, I definitely heard it before. It's a very interesting one. And yeah, there's a lot to that. It's far more of this type of, you know, occult ongoings are happening in the world. And a lot of big banks are using astrology. They want to time things right. They want to do it in the right connection, even company mergers and stuff like that. And just what we talked about before, you know, the ceremonies are being taken place at a certain point in time. And again, I go back to that question. Is this because it's ordained pretty much at that stage by a higher force, or is it that the angels that John Dee were trying to work with and develop his language of you know, Enochian magic, because it's a higher communication going on in some way, and therefore these deities or entities are actually, I don't know, helping you out on levels which maybe be unseen to human eyes? What do you think?
Maybe it's the other way around. Maybe it's that the humans are acting this way in accordance with some sort of angelic plan rather than the humans planning it out themselves.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I mean, maybe it's the reversal of the whole thing. You know, maybe it's the humans are just, you know, being syncretic of these astrological, solar, you know, alignments, if you will, you know, and aren't even aware of it. And it's being guided by some sort of higher entity of some kind. It's very possible.
Well, see, I would agree with that. I mean, just because it's you know, occult or unseen doesn't mean it's evil, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's good either. I'm always skeptical about these things. I want to question what it is for, and if that's the case, that would mean that mankind, maybe not individually on every little level, but the big events in history, the huge, and I mean, we do have signs of this. So people are having visions to their seeing things that are balls of light to spheres in the sky that are present at these ancient battles and stuff like that. It's like it's another force that are guiding mankind. So these huge, big steps that are altering history, maybe those are being, you know, orchestrated from beyond. Who knows?
It's possible. I guess when you're dealing with sort of, you know, when you're dealing with sort of this material, and what we're talking about here is, I guess at the end of the day, it's the old line. You can't have an up without a down. You can't have a black without a white. You can't have a good without an evil. So there's always going to be, you know, some sort of, you know, if you're going to look at it as a positive, sure, but there's always going to be some sort of negativity associated with it as well.
Yeah. And as we know, that had also, negativity has also to do with perspective, because what is good to one person might not be good to another. And so it depends on where we are on that symbolic chessboard, if you will, as well. What move is going to be beneficial, or what's going to be detrimental to us, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you know, the one thing I've learned in my life is some things that have happened in my life that were at the time negative actually turned out to be very positive. You know, at the time I was going through it, it was a very negative and dark time, but ultimately it yielded a positive result. Alternatively, I've been in things where I was very happy and thought I was doing great, which ultimately yielded a negative result. So, you know, you can't really have one without the other, and who knows? I mean, you know, we're all on this, you know, earth together, and we just have to get through the territory, if you will.
Well, what do you think about a larger question in consideration what we've talked about so far? If mankind actually is free, or if we can attain freedom, so much of this hinges on the ideas of rebellion. Even these groups and philosophers and people we've been talking about has this idea that we want to, as a mankind, kind of step out of that, you know, playpen, if you will, of either if it's God or even nature, what have you. But at the same time, we have a tendency to kind of be stuck, if you will, with where we're at. Even the fact that we're in human bodies means that there's going to be limitations in terms of what we can do as, you know, as a live being. So are we truly free? Will mankind ever be able to be free, a true rebellion of sorts, if you know what I'm getting at?
I think I understand what you're asking. I mean, I guess at the end of the day, we're just going to have to, you know, do what we think to be right in this world. Like you said, we're all ultimately, you know, under, you know, no matter what. I mean, like you said, we're in human bodies. We can only do so much, really. You know, we are limited. I do believe. I mean, it's a complex question. I do believe in both sort of this combination of free will. I mean, I certainly think, you know, we can make decisions on our own that have consequences. Alternatively, I just can't help but think sometimes the things that happen in life are just meant to be. I mean, you know, yeah. Or just, you know, I mean, it's just, you know, it's supposed to happen this way, if you were. I mean, I know for me personally, I mean, I've experienced both where, I mean, I know that, you know, I mean, I've done things on my own because I wanted to. I mean, I took the initiative, but also I've been part of things where, you know, things just, you know, it turned out the way it did. And I don't think no matter what I would have done, I would have gotten a different result, if that makes any sense.
Oh, sure.
I mean, I definitely experienced that as well. It's like, you know, no matter what you do, it's like a circuitous route. I mean, it's like no matter what you did, you were going to get the same result. You know, if you did it a different way 1,000 times, you're still going to get the same damn result. You know, alternatively, you know, you got to make the choice though. But it's like you get the same result. I mean, I definitely believe in sort of the concept of free will. I mean, I definitely believe in it, but I also can't help but think that there are certain things in this world that are just meant to be.
Very good. Now, let's see here in the last few minutes if there's anything else, something out of the book that you just, you know, like to talk a little bit more about, something that we've left out, and an interesting tidbit or something that would be tangible to wrapping things up here. What do you think, Robert?
I would say that, you know, I think that a lot of the book, I think that the book presents a lot of new material. I get into some symbolism to tie it to masonry, and I think a lot of it, you know, isn't out there already. There's some material that, you know, is brand new and fresh, especially when we're getting to these concepts of the Book of Enoch and its influence upon Freemasonry. I have a whole thing about, you know, some of the stuff, the one thing we didn't really talk about, but it's okay, and it's going to be too lengthy, but one of the things that you know, you get into Freemasonry and its Freemasonic symbols, one of the real interesting subjects is this concept of Union College in Schenectady, New York, which was the first college set up after the Revolution, and it's if you look at its template, and I got a whole thing on it. It's actually the actual Union College template is the Enochian symbol. It's the sun rising up out of the vault, if you will.
Really?
Maybe
you can tell us a little bit more about that. If you have time, we have. We could squeeze it in there if you want.
Yeah, I can, we'll wrap up on this. At the end of the Revolution, the first college that's set up is called Union College. It's in Schenectady, New York. And you're going to have to work with me with a wink-wink here. Union College is the first college in the United States to offer degrees, you know, degrees, quote-unquote, you know, right. You with me so far, in operative masonry, in stoneworking. And the guy who designs the template is a guy named J.J. Remy. He's a French architect working in Masonic circles with people like DeWitt Clinton, Ezra Ames, people like that. And if you look at the Union College template, it's the vaulted quadrangle with the sun emerging out of it. And of course, the building that represents the sun is a domed library. And if you're familiar with my book, domes on buildings or a domed building comes out of the work of a guy named Vitruvius, and his works are reworked by these two Renaissance masters named Battista and Palladio. And what they say is, if you're going to put a dome on a building, you know, and this is commercial buildings assigned, if you're going to put a dome on a building, it designates it as this chamber of the sun god Apollo. And it has three unique connotations. One is, if you're going to put it on a government building, such as you have in Washington, D.C.,
yeah.
Basically what you're investing it with is a chamber of light, of New Age democracy, if you will. If you put it on a library, you know, like the one at Union College, what you're investing it with is this concept of enlightenment, or New Age solar spiritual wisdom, basically. And then, of course, if you put it on a place like the Vatican, like St. Peter's, you're basically designating it as a chamber of the sun god Apollo, where, you know, Jesus, Mithras, is basically worshipped as the sun under the name Jesus. The Union College template, it's the vault with the dome building as the sun emerging out of it. And the Union College sigil or coat of arms is the virgin goddess Minerva, who is a wisdom goddess. And she's placed there as sort of this restoration of this lost knowledge. And if you think I'm stretching this, the motto of Union College is actually, we are all brothers under the protection of Minerva, which is obviously, you know, you see the Masonic connotations there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's a no-brainer. You asked me earlier in the show, you know, like who's doing this? I mean, you know, you asked me, like, who's doing this? Well, one of the people who is doing this is a guy named Leland Stanford. And what Leland Stanford does is he is a New Yorker, and he travels out west. And what he symbolically does is he borrows Minerva off of the Union College template, and he gets out to California. And Leland Stanford's a Mason, but he's also a Odd Fellow. And it's in my book. When Stanford gets out there, the first two Odd Fellow lodges are being set up in California, both the Grand Lodge and the First Lodge. If you look at the seals of the Odd Fellow lodges, it's Minerva with the mountain in the background with the sun coming over. Well, this of course becomes the state seal of California with Minerva on it.
Yeah.
And you can directly trace that through Leland Stanford back to the Union College seal of Minerva.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Minerva with her Liberty cap, the Phrygian cap. This is, you know, again, I actually go back to that idea that we talked earlier in the show, and this is something we could wrap up on again then. But if this is true, and it's even called Union College, Union, Unification, and everything else, but this is something that when we think more of unions, we think of, you know, liberal politics, more of on the left thing end of things, revolutionary movements, etc. And this is even where, you know, you have the whole idea of the Liberty Cap or the Phrygian Cap going back to, because this were, I think, slaves during a certain period in Greece or Minoa or something like that. I forget the whole history, that they adopted this, the red cap, if you will, the Liberty Cap. So we have these ideals of quote-unquote egalitarianism incorporated into this, yet at the same time, this is so interesting, when many people think about Freemasonry today, they think of almost something that would be more conservative or even right-wing, that it's an old, you know, just Christian old white guy sitting around and that's all there is kind of thing. So it's a tremendous contradiction. And if one looks at it first peripherally, it becomes very, very difficult to try to put this in a box, if you know what I'm getting at, Robert.
You can't put it in a box. It's too complex, because you have, you know, and even like within Freemasonry, I mean, you know, and we didn't get into it during this interview, maybe for another time, but, you know, and this ties back to when Freemasonry is being developed in the United States. It's different. It's different than it is in Europe. There's a break. You know, I mean, you know, we've already talked about this one break between the Blue Lodge and the High Degrees. There's actually another break between, you know, I mean, and this is just a real long story, and we're just not going to have time for it, but it's a division, what's called the modern and the ancients. And these are two competing forces within Masonry, and there's this symbolic break between them, and the European tradition follows one path, and the American tradition follows another path. It's very complex.
Well, you know what? That would actually be interesting to say for another time if you want to return at some point. There's, of course, much more in the book to talk about. There's a lot of more notes that we didn't have time to get for in this time. So we could keep that in mind, Robert, as we wrap up here, because it's always interesting to continue these conversations. So why don't we end with you giving out your details once again, Robert. Give us the title of your book, and if you want to give any hints to whatever you're working on next here as well.
Sure. The name of the book is called The Royal Arch of Enoch: The Impact of Masonic Ritual, Philosophy, and Symbolism. My name is Robert W. Sullivan IV. My website is www.robertwsullivaniv.com. The Royal Arch is out now. You know, if you go to my site, there's links to purchase it on Kindle, Nook. If you want the oversized paperback, you can get that too. It's a little more expensive, but it's out there. It's on iTunes. It's a 700-page book. It's only $9.99, so it should be affordable. I priced it low to make it affordable for everybody. I am currently working. That book's out. You can buy that right now. I'm currently writing my second book, which I'm literally writing right now, and I should have that done by the end of the summer or early fall of this year, and I'm targeting a late 13 or early 14 publication date. This book is called Cinema Symbolism, A Guide to Esoteric Imagery in Popular Movies, and it's an extension, it's a continuation of an extension of the final chapter of the Royal Arch book, which deals with Masonic and Enochian imagery in popular movies. The Cinema Symbolism book, just basically, it deals with themes of Freemasonry and Enochianism, but I also deal with themes of Jungian archetypes, tarot cards, astrology, mysticism, esoterica, mythology, Egyptian lore, being incorporated into these modern movies. And some of the chapters deal with The Wizard of Oz, the Back to the Future trilogy, the first Exorcist movie. I get into the mythology of vampirism and lycanthropy, and I'm writing it now, and it's coming along very well.
All right, very good. Looking forward to that one. Well, thank you for your time today, Robert, for sharing your perspective. It's very interesting to hear about some of these esoteric traditions, so it's been a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thank you, Heinrich.
We have some great shows coming up for you guys and gals. Danny Vendramini, Nils Harrit, Penny Pierce, Scott Volter, and a roundtable with Lloyd Pye, Brian Forrester, and Jerry Willis. We also have Daniel Uslin and Graham Hancock coming on further down the road. Hey, by the way, you can send us your guest suggestions if you think we're missing someone. We have, of course, many more guests to invite every time I go through some of these lists that we have. It feels like we're just getting started. We have so many more fascinating people to bring on board and much more to cover when it comes to the topics that we are into. But we'll get there. Much more is to discover and learn. You'll find our contact details under contact on redeyesmembers.com if you want to get in touch. Okay, well, that's the program for this time. Thank you for listening. As usual, Frederick and Elizabeth are working hard behind the scenes. So is Lana, who is also doing Radio 314 now, our latest edition. Check out her excellent programs, links from the front page on redeyesmembers.com or redeyescreations.com. Have a great rest of your day, and we will return with more soon.